Welcome to World of DAS, a show for data enthusiasts. I'm your host, Warren Hoffman, CEO of Safegraph and GP of Flex Capital. For more conversations, videos, and transcripts, visit safegraph.com/podcasts. Hello, fellow data nerds. My guest today is Blake Hall. Blake is the co-founder and CEO of ID.me, a secure digital identity network with over 100 million members. Blake, welcome to World of DAS.
Thanks, Warren. Appreciate you having me on.
I'm really excited. Now, passwords are something that's kind of like embedded in the fabric of internet today. And a lot of people don't even think about an alternative, even though like most people don't like passwords. It's like, why are we still using passwords today? And what's a better solution?
Yeah, I think these organizations tend to deliver services from the perspective of their bureaucracy and not for what is best from the point of view of the consumer. Of course, across the web, we're accustomed to this. Passwords are just terrible, and our brains weren't meant to manage one or two strong passwords, much less like 300 going on 500, which is what I think the latest surveys have it at. When we first started working with the Department of Veterans Affairs, they actually had 500 plus veteran-facing websites.
Oh my gosh. A veteran may have to log into like 20 of them or something like that, all with different passwords and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you think about, they had this app for like VA facility finders, and there were 40 of them, the same app that different parts of the organization had decided was a good idea, but wasn't communicating with the others. And nobody was really thinking about, well, how do Americans want to authenticate? What's the most convenient pathway for people to authenticate? And you'll see this a lot in technology where organizations look at the world from their point of view and not from the point of view of the consumer. And I came from outside the industry, obviously, like my only real work experience prior to ID.me was a lawn mowing business, lifeguarding, and people shooting at me in the army. And I said, I think that people should have a digital wallet that is their login and their verified data that moves with them. And that if you could have that experience, you could not only get rid of passwords, but you could also dramatically streamline access to really important civic benefits. You could increase financial inclusion. That's what we're doing. But it's really interesting in that each organization on its own can't solve this problem. You need a utility like Visa or like MasterCard as a third party to really change the way that the ecosystem works. And that's what ID.me is doing.
So many times when you go to a website, like you're often like re-entering the same information. In some ways makes sense because you want different people to have access. Maybe you don't want everyone to have access to your credit card, but if you're buying something, you want them to have access. And then which credit card? And then, okay, well, of course, you don't want everyone to have access to your passport, but every once in a while, you're flying international, you need United Airlines or whoever to get access to your passport information. And then, of course, you have like information about your kids or something. You're constantly, and they're like, oh, I don't remember my kids, whatever, social security number. You have to go like look it up, and it's a big hassle. It just makes sense that there would be like some sort of system. But we've been talking about this forever. And still today, I mean, every company, including yours, maybe solves like a little piece of it there. We're still having like retype all this information over and over again. Like, do you ever see there's going to be a convergence? Or do you think for a long time, we're going to have gazillion systems?
There will be convergence. I'm a big student of economic and American history and looking at how markets develop. Mark Twain has this quote that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I think you can see that in the patterns of payment wallets, which are really the first version of what I would call identity wallets that are more holistic and representative of how our physical wallets work. And when you think about how did Visa even come to be, we take Visa and MasterCard for granted that we can just avoid paying with cash and have these portable credentials that move in our wallets. But the story of Visa starts with Bank of America and Bank of AmeriCard in 1958, where they literally just mailed out 65,000 credit cards. And people didn't know what credit cards were. It took 18 years where Bank of America actually cultivated the market and matured it to an extent where it made sense for the network layer to uncouple. And then you had the emergence of Visa and these issuing banks. For identity wallets, ID.me really is like Bank of AmeriCard. We're not just a digital wallet. We are an issuer of legal identity that federal agencies and state government agencies look at the credentials that we can issue into our digital wallet as legal proof that you're you. And what that's doing is it's allowing Americans to have single sign-on where their verified identity and their personal information is moving with them for the first time ever in this country across 15 federal agencies, including Social Security, IRS, Treasury, HHS, and so on, 30 plus states, 600 private sector organizations. And right now, we have 120 million users, and we verified over 50 million Americans' identities to the Department of Commerce standard. It's kind of like digital real ID, if you will, to like verify that you're you.
Where do you think this is all going? I love that you're talking your book, which is awesome. But like, if we had to like think out 5 or 10 years, because we certainly have more passwords today than we did 10 years ago. Maybe people use a password manager. So it's a little bit weird. They may have like an Uber password to get into the password manager, and then they may not even know all the passwords that they have and stuff like that. Are we going to have fewer things? Are more folks going to use systems, whether it's ID.me or Google or other types of things? Are there going to be a small number of aggregators? Are they going to have a lot of power, so we're going to need to regulate those? How do you think the world's going to play out?
I think it's going to end with 4. It'll be us, Clear, and the phone manufacturers like Google and Samsung and then Apple as the 4 digital wallets. Just like there's Visa, MasterCard, Amex, Discover, I think you'll see a similar breakdown. And there will be consolidation. I think the first identity wallet that can do social login, personalization, and CRM at the top of funnel, the verified identity can reduce fraud and chargebacks. It can do payments. That company will be a $100 billion plus company with a real shot at getting to a trillion in this market. And that's where the convergence will really have a material impact on people's lives, where the same login is facilitating account sign up and sign in, the same level of personalization that Amazon delivers to folks, that data is now untethered and can move with the consumer. So you could have a really exciting wave of innovation where newer app developers, if they're able to curry trust with folks who are signing up, those folks could provide all sorts of information about their profiles in a given context that would then change the way that they're interacting. I don't think that's too far off. I think that's 5 to 7 years off, because there's a lot of things that need to be true in order to mature the market to a point where you start to see that convergence. It's coming between mobile driver's licenses, and that's how the phone manufacturers are. They're looking to the DMVs to be the issuers. ID.me and Clear have built our own issuing capabilities, which has allowed us to move a lot faster in terms of verifying that Orin is Orin, which is the hardest part of digital identity, is verifying that you're you on the internet.
It is getting better. There was a point where if you want to open up like a bank account, you'd have to actually go physically into the bank and like bring your like birth certificate or something. And now you can at least move your face around or something. It's not the best, but at least it kind of works. You can get a bank account open a lot quicker. You're right. It's still many years away from where the world you believe is going.
That's right. It was 1958 to 1976 for Bank of America to become Visa. And then it was really into the late 80s where Visa was ubiquitous and everywhere that you want to be. And you even had, I think, the Amex Costco deal just ended in like 2016. Diners Club, which also started in the 1950s, is still a brand that's owned by Discover. So these market developments where there are these third-party ecosystems that need to develop to enable commerce, to make people's lives more convenient, literally take 30 to 40 years from inception to being ubiquitous, just given all the coordination and standardization that's involved to change the way the market works.
To me, there seems to be like 3, besides for like the technology providers like you guys, there's like 3 other stakeholders. There's the actual site or company where you're logging into. There's the consumer that's logging in. And then sometimes there's the company, which either the consumer is the employee of or has some sort of relationship with, which is also maybe paying for some of these logins, where like Okta or something plays in. Everyone I know hates Okta. It's just so annoying and it's terrible experience and stuff like that. Do you see the company as the stakeholder coming into it as well?
So back to Visa, which again, I think is the 1.0 version of the market. There's 5 stakeholders in Visa. You got the issuing bank, you've got the acquiring bank, you've got the merchant, you've got the cardholder, and then you've got the network in the middle. And so identity, in a way that works like our physical wallets work, is actually 6-sided. So it has many of the same elements. In fact, substitute the payment processors and acquiring banks for like an Okta or a Ping or a ForgeRock that help with processing credentials, just like you have Verifone and Ingenico as payment terminals.
Right. There's like the auth zeros of the world and stuff like that, right?
Yeah. All this infrastructure that helps each organization kind of manage and facilitate their identities. You've got Salesforce managing CRM and things like that. The thing that's different with identity is that you have this nearly infinite number of credential issuers, depending on the use case. So where did Oren go to school? And what are your educational degrees? What is your criminal background history if you want to chaperone your kids on a field trip where you need to go get screened for the school system? What are your content subscriptions? Netflix and HBO. And
it's infinite. It's infinite. Yeah.
And so what you're figuring out, we call this workflow-based return on investment. The way that we see the world is that there's a lot of toll booths, and these are processes that are manually administrated. They're very expensive and they're very time consuming. So for instance, we do all the guest check-in now for MGM and Wynn. And getting to Las Vegas, waiting in line with your bags for an hour at happy hour was one of the most frustrating experiences that I had, not only as a traveler, but also as somebody who would go to conventions a lot out in Las Vegas. It's just a huge penalty on your life. To be able to automate that workflow and to have it work more like airline boarding passes is really transformational in terms of how it gives people, you know, time back.
I mean, that is so frustrating. Just the fact that you can't even walk into your room with your phone and stuff like that. Like, why is that going on? It seems like the airlines would have way more regulations than hotels. Why is it easier to go to an airline, board an airplane, than it is to go in a hotel?
It's a great point. That's kind of why when we looked at it, I think just a level of like fragmentation and like technology forwardness, there's more pressure on airports to screen people in an expeditious manner than there is on hotels. And I even think there's certain types of hotels that have operational challenges that mimic airports. So if you think about airports are the proverbial bottleneck. Everyone has to go through it, whereas hotels much more fragmented. So it's more dispersed. But when you get to those large properties in a concentrated market like Las Vegas, you see these operational challenges. And now you're kind of left with smaller companies relative to the airlines and airports that have to solve for, well, how can I develop that same level of convenience and service? So there's all these things that make it hard for why passwords still dominate the internet and why it's taking so long to solve for it. But what's really exciting is that if you think about the easy pass and the interstate, you can look not only at a given workflow, but a broader workspace to say, well, what do I need to do to get to the airport? How do I get through security? How do I board the airplane? How do I get to the hotel? How do I check in? After I'm checked in, what restaurants am I going to? What shops am I going to? Why isn't there a digital passport, a wallet that allows you to bring your own identity with you to make those workflows more convenient? And that's why it's so hard, because the stakeholders who are involved at every step of that journey, this is just taking a trip to Vegas that we're talking about, there's a ton of them. And you have to convince them that you're the right solution, that they should allow this third-party network in there. And it takes years to just pick like one workspace, one interstate, if you will, and then to become that easy pass from start to finish across that life experience.
Okay. Yeah. Now, there's these countries like Estonia that have, at least according to the press, one login across all government services. I think Singapore has some sort of national ID app that integrates. Can you ever imagine something like that happening in the US?
Yes. I mean, we're building it. Some important differences. I think.
So we have like the city, state, national. It's much harder in the US.
Much harder. And there's, in America, there's inherent distrust of government based on our founding and how we threw off our English friends and versus what you have in Europe. But if you look at what consumers value that is the same, they value convenience. And so in Sweden and Norway, there's a product called Bank ID, where they don't have a different login for healthcare and government and banking. They have Bank ID. The average Swede uses it 5 times per day.
Oh, wow.
It's Visa for everything, not just payments. In Estonia, where Tanel, our co-founder and CTO, has been just a great partner the last 14 years, is from, same thing. Now, Estonia only has 1.3 million people, so it's much smaller. It's like a large city in many ways. But that is the blueprint for what we're building. I think in an American model, the federal government, I don't think should or ever will like mandate a national ID for Americans. What you will see, though, I think, is based on these standards that are set by the Department of Commerce and NIST, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, within the Department of Commerce, you will start to see innovation from us, from companies like Clear and the phone manufacturers, to create options for portable and reusable identity that Americans can benefit from. And so you'll have a much more competitive market based on choice. It's going to take longer to develop because it's not mandated by the government. I think you very much are seeing, as those four companies grow, ourselves included, the emergence of a new consumer-centric model of identity where your login and your data moves with you.
India, over the last decade or so, has moved into more of a national ID. Walk us through what we can learn, both the pros and the cons of how they rolled it out from that.
So there's a few things. I think what's interesting about the developing world is that they'll often like skip steps that you might see in the developed world. And so if you look at the challenges that India had with national identity, you've maybe got a farmer who was born like 30 to 35 springs ago, not quite sure, one name, no record of this person existing. Where do you even start? So actually, they started with biometrics and they just said, you know what, your face is going to be your identity. And that's how they scaled. Now, because it was centrally mandated and because the technology didn't really have time to mature and get market tested against different use cases, there were tremendous issues that they ran into in terms of how the technology works, privacy controls, all sorts of things that made it subject to fraud. And so I don't know all the details, but I do know that there's been quite a lot of turmoil around how it was executed. And that's sort of the downside of mandating a centralized system that's then rolled out at scale to like everybody. So the way they approached the problem was quite interesting. I think devil always in the details as far as the execution. In an American model, folks need to be able to opt out. I think in the same way that we would say to any of our customers as we create a digital flow is like, hey, we're creating kind of the airline boarding pass model. That doesn't mean that you can take the counter away though. The counter is still there. If you don't want to go through this, you still have exactly what was there yesterday. And in fact, the counter maybe has better service now because the line is a lot shorter as a lot of folks are going through the digital channel. But these notions of really careful technological development that's been honed by the market, privacy controls that are built in proactively, what you see in Europe with GDPR, what you see in California now with the California Consumer Privacy Act, that's a major difference that you will see in America and in the EU versus India, where there's a lot less regulation, you know, for better or worse, about how they rolled out their system.
This idea that like you could even like steal someone's identity is so crazy. And just like the fact that someone could like get your IRS return money instead of you, or bill Medicare 50,000 times for like fictitious patients and stuff like that.
Catheters, which they just lost $2 billion to, yeah.
And then you don't get notified. You would think like if someone's randomly doing something for me, like getting a return for my taxes, I would get like a little an email or something being like, hey, Oren, someone just got $300 from the IRS in your name or something. As we move to more and more of these ID systems, is it going to be harder and harder for criminals to steal IDs? Is that part of the benefit?
I think it's becoming easier for them to steal IDs, which is quite honestly why there's such a tailwind around these portable and reusable frameworks. I'm sure, familiar with ChatGPT. You have to be living under a rock if you weren't with that one. But there are these tools out there in the dark web called FraudGPT and WormGPT, which are these open source large language models that have been retrained to be evil. And they're being used by scammers. And so if you'll recall, I think a year, maybe 18 months ago now, the FBI worked with LinkedIn and announced that there were 32 million fraudulent accounts on LinkedIn. I mean, that's an astonishing amount.
Yeah. I'm surprised it's that low, honestly. I think I've personally done a few of a million of those, yeah,
right,
over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what we're seeing is this unbelievable sophistication in social engineering and scams, where these aren't the old Nigerian prince emails with like the typos and the spelling errors where you can be like, come on, give me a break. Like, I'm not going to fall for that. These are criminals who are luring young people disproportionately into job interviews and then harvesting all their information, their documents, their selfies, everything you can imagine that could then be used to perpetrate fraud. And then they go off and they pick off organizations that have their own siloed identity systems one by one. And so there's just been a massive, massive increase in those types of attacks and the batting average, where folks who would not normally fall for a scam that's run by somebody who's not proficient in English now through these large language models are able to do that. We've seen some of the more sophisticated nation state linked groups in Asia and Eastern Europe using generative AI to generate counterfeit documents. And in fact, just on X a few days ago, there was a cryptocurrency exchange and a well-known document authentication vendor that was defeated using, I think, an ID card that took the researcher like all of 10 minutes to go ahead and create and submit. And then they were in and had passed know your customer controls that are there to prevent the financing of terrorism. It's a real problem.
And we're moving to where what's you can do deepfakes on voice now very easily. You can do deepfakes on video super easily. There was one recently where an accountant went on a Zoom and saw like their CFO and a bunch of other people on the Zoom. And it was all deepfaked and they ended up wiring $25
million. $25 million.
Yeah. So this is happening now at a pace that is going to be, we're going to see an unbelievable amount of fraud in the next few years.
I agree. Yeah. And that's where there's a different type of technology. So a lot of folks are familiar with facial recognition, which is similarity to say, like, I see a picture of Oren and I go, that's Oren's face. Presentation attack detection is testing to see whether that selfie is in fact a genuine human face. And is it that person's face or is it a deep fake? There's an ISO standard for it. I think it's 30701-3, if I'm not mistaken. But that presentation attack detection is testing to see, is that really Oren in front of me or is that a synthetic, a deep fake, somebody holding up an image or a video? That class of technology, which verifies that that is in fact a real human face, is going to be the most important thing to protect our social media conversations and, quite frankly, our democracy from extensive manipulation.
There's no way that that's going to work long time. Like, it's just a cat and mouse game. Or do you think that's possible? We'd have to like cryptographically sign everything or something? Or
no, you can definitely defeat it through multiple layers for sure. Security at the end of the day is profit equation where it's like, what's the benefit of the attack? And then what does it cost me to do it? And can I scale that? The same way an entrepreneur would scale a business.
So it might be worth it to go steal $25 million, but not worth it to steal $300 or something.
Right. And so when you're dealing with like internet fraud, I mean, one of the first things you deal with are devices. And generally, it's expensive to have more devices and to procure them and to manage them, even if you're a bad guy. And so the relationship of an attacker to a device is important. The presentation attack detection technology that we use has defeated, I mean, I haven't seen a deepfake get through on the face biometric side in years. Now, whether it'll stay that way is a question, but there are really cool technologies that are out there that have a way of piercing the veil, so to speak, on some of these attacks using randomized bursts of color and other things where the face will refract light in a way that is not replayable. And so I think time will tell, but for right now, we're covered. Maybe tomorrow we won't be.
In today's world, everything is very decentralized. And so there's lots of login providers, et cetera. And the bad part about that is that, well, a lot of them have really bad security and they're very, very vulnerable for attack. The good part is that because there's lots of them, all of them only have access to a very small amount of your information. And a lot of it is really not that valuable information anyway, or something. And the fact that you subscribe to the service or something. If you move into a world where things get much more concentrated, okay, well, the good news is that you're way better security. It's way harder to hack. But the bad news is if you do hack it, if you remember the OPM hack from 10 years or so ago, you hacked it. Now, all of a sudden, you have access to like the deepest secrets that are out there. It's all concentrated in one place. So is there a way to have our cake and eat it too? Still somehow like it's centralized, but there's different encrypted packets, rooms within rooms within rooms, or how do you see that evolving?
You brought up a really good point. The first thing you want to do from a privacy and security standpoint is we're not innovating in a vacuum here. So you want to say, what is this model relative to the model that exists today? And is this better or worse on different dimensions that you can look at the trade-offs and decide on balance? From a policy perspective, what makes sense. One of the challenges of, and one of the reasons why it's taken so long in this country to have portable and reusable identities through digital wallets is because the companies that have the most scale and have the most logins issued to consumers tend to be the largest application providers. And that introduces really serious questions of privacy, where if you're Facebook or Google, you have somebody's entire like social media and messaging history or their search history, and then you start to see their login activity across the web, we kind of view that like Ghostbusters. Don't cross those streams.
And Apple, for sure, right? I mean, you just take the few biggest guys.
Exactly. We kind of say there's three layers of identity. You've got the trust layer, which is the wallet layer. That's you and your verified credentials. Generally public. Senators' faces and their stuff are out there on their websites and your educational degrees. If you just looked at LinkedIn or Facebook, I would posit that like 95% plus of that is public. You could FOIA my military service. The next layer of identity is the application layer, digital apps. And that would be what we're all familiar with, from Netflix to Facebook to TikTok and Instagram, whatever. And then you've got the physical app layer. We think that the trust layer needs to be partitioned from the application layer of the economy. Whenever you have Facebook or Google trying to come down and welding those together, we call that a voyeur state. If you weld all three together through like WeChat or Tencent, you have a surveillance state where China's actually using like biometrics to surveil you. In our model, you basically have your own data. Most of it's already public. If you went to state licensing databases, that's where doctors are registered. That's where beauticians and dog walkers and plumbers and every, it's already out there and it's publicly available because it's in the public interest for these credentials to be available. What is difficult at the trust layer is that actually Orin, or is it somebody pretending to be Orin?
And also, is it true? Did Orin try to fake it or something like that? Or I could try to claim I run a marathon in 2 hours or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you think about these claims and everything else, what the wallet gets into is like, this is Orin and are these claims true or not? But you don't get into behavior. And that's really what we're talking about, the difference between the trust layer and the application layer. We want to know who you are. We do not want to know what you do. If you had our logs, it'd be like Blake Hall, a veteran logged into the VA. And I logged into the IRS tax season, paying my taxes. What I do within those applications, though, if it's healthcare at the VA, tax at the IRS, that's decentralized within the application layer.
Yeah. Okay. So they store that somehow. Okay.
That's right. And it's how physical wallets work, right? I'm checking into a medical appointment. I pull out my wallet. Hey, I'm me. My wallet goes back in. Then the system is like, well, you have an appointment with Dr. So-and-so for whatever, but it's a different system. So that is how it works. It allows for the decentralization and the separation of the application layer from the trust layer. And it's a really important concept. It's also really important to winning and to creating this vision of user-centric identity, because if you are a major application provider, you compete with applications that you would want to have adopt your utility. So if you're Amazon trying to get Amazon Pay everywhere, do you think you're going to get that into Walmart or into grocery stores? Probably not. So that's one of the reasons why it's taken this long to solve this password problem, is that all these incumbents who have these natural advantages of scale, they have trust issues and they have competitive brand issues that have prevented and inhibited the development of a market that's built around consumers.
One of the craziest things to me about this whole thing is that we have this secret 9-digit number that all of us have. And we're supposed to like keep it so secret, but we give it out randomly to people. The social security number like makes no sense to me. And I think historically, like, it was never meant to be like secret either, right? It's like this very weird thing. It's like you can't tell anyone your social security, this random code or something. It's like it will unlock everything in your life. It seems like we've got to get away from that, right?
There's two things that are going on. I think the social security number is incredibly important as a unique identifier for Americans. It's like a Yellow Pages address, to your point. It's fine. It's all been compromised, by the way. You know, Equifax breach, OPM.
Yeah, Equifax.
Another 80 million. Yeah. So the toothpaste is out of the tube. And so a social is helpful for what we call an identity resolution, which is to say, maybe there's like...
It's a join key.
That's right. There's 30 Orrin Hoffmans out there that have the same name and date of birth. But which one are we really talking about? Well, the social can winnow it down to like one. What we're seeing now, though, is that there's been so much synthetic identity fraud that's entered the market, because the Social Security Administration will not corroborate social security numbers outside of financial institutions that are using this pretty expensive system that Social Security administers. And so that's created an opportunity for criminals to inject what are called synthetic identities. They will take a child's social security number or a made up and fictitious social security number. They'll add a name and date of birth to like a credit application, and then they'll create what's called a synthetic identity because it represents a person that doesn't actually exist. If you have kids, I strongly recommend that you add them to your credit information as quickly as possible so that their social security number is entered with their correct name and date of birth. Like all of my kids have their own credit cards.
Explain this. So you actually went and got credit cards for your kids?
That's right. It's just like taxes. It's a race against bad guys to like claim your own identity before someone else does.
So you went and essentially claimed, you got little Johnny or something like that. You go claim his thing somewhere, get him a little Visa card. So that's kind of somewhat tied to your address and everything, so somebody else doesn't get there first.
Correct. Once you understand how credit bureaus and data brokers work, the life cycle for ingestion doesn't come from the government. It comes from a credit application. It's kind of first come, first serve. The first time that they see that social security number and it's tied to a name and date of birth is what is entered as the initial record for that identity. And what kids, unfortunately, across the country in pretty significant numbers are finding is that they're turning 18, they go to file for credit. Oh, your social's already been used and it's been tied to extensive fraud where your credit score is going to be awful.
Isn't there a way for, and this is my naive thing, for the bank to know that this social security number was issued only 6 years ago, so this person's probably 6 years old or something, or there's no way for them to know that?
It used to be that Social Security would issue social security numbers based on the geographic location that you were born and in a relatively chronological order.
Yeah, like nines were California and ones were Massachusetts or something or whatever it was. Yeah.
Yep. Some years ago, though, they stopped doing that. It's like this randomized pattern. And some criminal groups have claimed, hard to know, that they can reverse engineer the algorithm. But now it's randomized. So there is no correlation of a social security number to age or geolocation of birth. And the industry has lost that as a fraud signal to go, oh, this date of birth and this social couldn't possibly be tied together. And so that's created the opening for fraud. So the first kind of PSA is like, if you have kids, like as soon as you can, piggyback them on your credit so that what the credit bureaus have matches their actual identity. And if somebody else tries to use their social security number, that would be flagged as fraud because you've already added your children to your credit report and there would be a discrepancy. So I strongly urge you to do that. But I think when you look at synthetic identity fraud, several years ago, the Federal Reserve Bank released a report that was the fastest growing form of fraud in the financial services market. So billions and billions of dollars lost every year. And that really is another reason that the industry is moving pretty strongly towards biometrics. Similar to what India dealt with, you do have nearly 45 million Americans who either don't have credit history or what's called thin file. They're young and maybe they changed their name recently. They're listed
in a recent immigrant or something like that.
That's right. What a lot of DMVs will do when you register your identity is they'll check to see if that face has been tied to a different identity. And there's now a direct link between the person who's applying for the identity and the identity itself. It's not a number. It's your actual selfie.
But how does it work? When you go to the DMV, you take like one picture and just some random photo, and doing a photo match against hundreds of millions of other random photos with just really also just one picture is incredibly difficult to do. You have a lot of false positives and false negatives, even with the best algorithms. And I'm sure the DMV does not have the best algorithms out there. Is it even effective? If they even a very small number of false positives or false negatives, you'll see a million matches or something. It's not going to be that helpful.
It's much more accurate than that, way more accurate than that. The top performing algorithms are, if you look at the NIST facial recognition vendor testing programs, way, way more accurate, especially with DMV quality photos. You would be looking at a match rate that is much more likely to be a true match than a false positive. And if you took care to configure the technology the way it needs to be, and without going too deep into the weeds, the same way that you kind of see a person, you're like, oh, I...
So all the DMVs somehow are like sending their photos to a more centralized system that does the fingerprint on the photos and everything?
I don't know if the DMVs are working cross-functionally. There are some law enforcement databases that do that. But certainly within each DMV that has enabled this technology, you've got millions of records that are doing it. I know like Arizona is one of the examples of a DMV that does this and has caught folks going through that were pretending to be somebody else or applying for multiple identities with the same face. the question again is like, given how it's configured and there's all these things called like confidence intervals that can cut down on the false positives, what is the gain versus what is the potential harm? The potential harm, if somebody especially could fly in an aircraft, this is 9/11, 23 years ago, can put everyone else at risk by traveling under a false identity, versus you've got maybe a 20% false positive rate within a pool. You know, the corollary of that would be like you got an 80% true positive rate where people are up to no good registering different identities as the same person. Is that worth it? That's a policy question. I think when you look at the security risks and the amount of fraud that's being perpetrated that has been lost, I don't think it's a particularly close call, given that if you abandon that in favor of things like data brokers and that, there's much more structural bias, particularly against lower income Americans, where they get stuck waiting for weeks and months or have to go in person for services relative to facial biometrics, which in our testing has shown to be the most equitable out of all the components that we've tested as far as true matches.
We could be living in a world very soon, or maybe we already are, where back in the day, if you're like a spy or something, you would get a legend, you would have a false identity or something like that. You'd show up at another country. Nowadays, if you get flagged in one country, they could be sharing with another country. If you get flagged in China, maybe you now can't show up in Venezuela or something. You're just burned forever, which makes it very hard to like have these kind of more undercover-ish agents and stuff. Is that your experience? Like, it's just going to be harder and harder to like be a spy?
1,000%. I mean, if you look at what China's already done to our intelligence network, there's a reason it's hard to get intel from that country.
Yeah. And you don't know if they're going to share it or not with some country or something, or they have like some sort of API or something going through. Now, speaking of defense geopolitics, as you mentioned, you're a veteran. Three American soldiers were recently killed in Jordan. And I think if you ask the average American, we probably didn't even know we had troops there near the Syrian border, and we're becoming more and more vulnerable to things like drone attacks and stuff. Where do you see this going? Are we going to have, because a lot of our bases are a little bit more decentralized, which is hard to have defenses, are we going to be a lot more central? Where's that going to start going?
Again, we're trying to maintain the peace and regional stability in America as the world's only superpower. Plays a really important part in that. You can see that with the Houthis and the shipping lanes. If America doesn't keep those shipping lanes open, then who does? So who's protecting the Norwegian tankers and everything else that's moving through? The real question of that region is what to do with Iran. The Iranian influence is just unbelievably malign. There was a guy that I was hunting when I was over there. His name is Qais Khazali. And 2 weeks after the October 7th attacks, the leaders of Hamas were in Iraq meeting with Qais Khazali, who's a leader of an Iranian paramilitary group. So you can see the influence of Iran across the region, and really this contest between Iran and its proxies and Saudi Arabia and its proxies and political interests. And America's caught really in the middle, trying to maintain regional stability in the midst of Saudi Arabia and Iran really pursuing adversarial agendas. And so it's really unfortunate. Obviously, when American service members are caught in the middle of that, and the drone attacks are just this new feature of this 3D battlefield. But back to the basics, what is our strategy for the Middle East and for Iran in particular in order to stop the unrest that they're sowing throughout the region that is causing a lot of suffering and loss of life?
Now, you were involved in our operations in Iraq. We went in there 21 years ago. And a lot of people would say that that operation has in some ways made Iran even stronger. So it had a lot of unintended consequences and stuff. As someone who served there and probably experienced a lot of loss of friends and other types of things, like how do you square that in your own head?
It's terrible. I mean, before we went in, I told my friends, like, this is going to be my generation's Vietnam. And
you thought that even just going in yourself?
Yeah, okay. Before I even went to combat. General Petraeus had that famous line during the invasion when he turns to the reporter and he goes, tell me how this ends. I was a senior at Vanderbilt University and some of Rumsfeld's aides came through and they were citing all these statistics and they go, 80% of Iraqis don't approve of attacks and coalition forces, yada, yada. And my hand shot up and they're like, yes, Cadet Hall. And I was like, sir, the corollary of that is that 20% do. In a nation of 25 million, that's 5 million people. third world demographics, going to skew younger. So let's cut it in half for males. It's 2.5 million, lop off 500K. You're left with about 2 million fighting age males against 125,000 coalition troops. But with a tooth to tail ratio, which is logistics to warfighters, of 7-1, it's really 25,000 American warfighters against about 2 million Iraqi insurgents. Don't you think that's not enough soldiers? And they said, well, our war planners are too good for that. And I was like, actually, General Shinseki, you know, and they were like, all right, next question. General Shinseki Abizade, I grew up in a military family with a very clear understanding of the General Powell's doctrine, like the American way of war. When you go to war with a clear American purpose, national interest that's at stake, win decisively, come home.
Have a clear objective.
Yeah. And we lacked all that clarity. And so exactly, there's a lot of history in the region with the British drew like arbitrary borders under the Sykes-Picot agreement that have created these illegitimate governments. And if you look at what Saddam Hussein did as far as the atrocities that he perpetrated, they weren't against Sunni Arabs who were his political base. They were against the Kurds gassing like Halabja and against the Shia and Dujail and the Marsha Arabs after they rose up against him. So the violence is concentrated against the groups that don't perceive the leader of the country as legitimate. And when we upset that balance and created a power vacuum, Iran absolutely exploited it. And I think that is the legacy of our involvement in Iraq, is that we just gave Iran a lot more power and influence over Iraq in a way that is still playing out in a very negative manner across the region.
And the U.S. in some ways has the best trained, you know, warfighters, et cetera, but we are slowly losing our advantage because somebody with a $200 drone can do what we used to be able to do with a $20 million drone. And you're starting to see these even outs where someone with a very small amount of budget and a little bit of ingenuity and not having to deal with all the red tape that you have to do in the U.S. So it's going to be harder and harder to fight our adversaries in the future. Or do you not agree with that?
I do agree. I mean, we'd have these multi-$100 million electronic warfare systems that were deployed, and without giving away the specific tactics, I mean, a base station with Reynolds Wrap would defeat, you know, like 550 later, you know, I've defeated this system just by adapting. And that's really the thing, is if you have a centralized bureaucracy and in our procurement system, which was built to fight corruption, not to innovate, but to fight corruption, up against really, really cellular level enemies that are adapting and iterating on the edge all the time, you're going to lose until you adapt. And General McChrystal is, I think, the best operating general of our time. If General Petraeus is the best strategist, McChrystal on the operations, his saying was, it takes a network to fight a network. And until we push more of that authority down to the edge and funding down to the edge, where we can iterate in real time and have less of these centralized, years-long, complex deployments and really get into the cat and mouse game, we're going to continue to get owned. And the latest example of that is like these drones coming from Yemen that cost thousands of dollars to build, and we're shooting them down with missiles that cost millions. even when you lose, because like the economics of that don't scale.
Yeah. It's really interesting. Now, separately, obviously, you run a very fast-growing company. I saw an interesting tweet from you asking about how to hire executive hires and open-ended questions that you ask them to see how their mind works. Like, what are some of the good open-ended questions for hiring?
Sure. And just to preface it, I noticed Anand Mehta, who's our chief people officer, ran talent for Ray Dalio at Bridgewater for 10 years. We'd be in conversations with executives, and I'd leave, and I'd go, Anand, I couldn't be more clear. Like, I told him exactly what I wanted them to do. And he would go, you're not going to see any change in behavior. He goes, all they heard was that you're just giving them more work and they don't know how to think more creatively about how to be more efficient and how to prioritize their work. And I was like, what do you mean? And so Anand introduced me to this theory called stratum, which is essentially understanding how somebody's brain works. And we all hear the same words in this question, and I'll provide a few examples. But the way that our brain processes that question and structures it, and the time horizon that we think across and everything else, is quite different. So if we were to take a relatively benign question like, tell me about the value of a bachelor's degree, the way that Thomas Jefferson would answer that question is going to be quite different from your typical high school senior. the high school senior is going to be like, well, you know, bachelor of science, bachelor of arts, it could do this vocational thing that maybe I'm thinking about. You're down at a very tactical, linear level thinking over the next 2 or 3 years. Jefferson and systems level thinkers, they'll reframe the question. They'll go, well, what's the purpose of education? And what's the purpose of education at a country level, at a community level, at a team level, and at an individual level? And so they're thinking across different time horizons, and then they're thinking about why you even need an education in the first place and what you're after. And what's really interesting is that thinkers can go down. So like Jefferson can go all the way down to the tactical conversation and hang there, but the tactical thinkers can't go up. And you will see this. Another question you could ask is like, should we legalize cannabis? Which may be an odd question to get in an employment interview, but is one that we'll ask folks. And again, we don't really particularly care.
Yeah, what the argument. You want to hear the argument rather than, yeah, exactly.
Who you ascribe. We care about how do you see the problem? How are you structuring it? What are the different trade-offs that are at play? And so it's less important about the thing that you decide is more important than the other. It's more important about laying out the picture and understanding how you think.
What I like about the cannabis question is it's a well-known argument. If someone's just parroting back to you what everyone's heard before the argument, then it's not as interesting. But if they're coming up with something new and interesting, or I've thought about it in this interesting way, or then it's like, oh, wow, tell me more. But if someone's just like, oh, yeah, like whatever, here's the talking points on one side or the other, it's harder to imagine them going deep on things.
Yeah, 1,000%. And so what you'll start to see the difference is the lower level stratums, like 1, 2, and 3, they're all linear relationships. So A, B, C, and it's kind of what you'd expect from somebody who's like a first line manager or below. The systems level thinkers start to see relationships between concepts. So actually A, B, C, that influences E over here. And then E as a concept actually is maybe in tension with this other thing over here. And so 4 is like you can start to see relationships between concepts and indirect effects. And then 5 is where things start to become simple. You can truly see the field for how concepts interplay with other concepts, and you can simplify it. So it's to say, all right, here's how it all works and interacts at a systems level. But these are like the 3 things that matter. And if we influence these things in this way, and mathematically, it's a pretty small percentage of the population. You're talking about 1%, maybe less, that can see the field in that way. And it's like speed. It's immutable in the context of a business. In the same way that once you can understand how someone's brain structures information and processes it, whether it's complex or simple, you get a sense for how, when you're giving them a task, if they can see what you can see or not. And the thing is, if you're more than one stratum off from somebody who reports to you, it's going to feel like screaming into the abyss. Having built a multi-billion dollar company like yourself, I'm sure you've seen along the way where it's like, well, why did some executives scale and were able to like keep up and some just kind of hit their ceiling? And even though they were trying really hard and coming to work with like great intent, just weren't able to see what you're able to see. And so something that seems pretty easy to a systems level thinker, it turns out, is pretty hard to somebody whose brain doesn't work that way, in the same way that a kid who's fast can't really grok why another kid who's not fast isn't fast. It's just something that is true. This framework allows you to see that and to screen for it. And it's enormously powerful because you can be much more kind and empathetic once you realize that this person's showing up at work, they're trying really hard to come through for you. They don't want to let you down. But if they're not fast, you don't want to be cruel and say, if only you cared, you'd be fast, right? Imagine if your sports coach told you that. It would just be right. Devastating.
Is there a sense that obviously if someone is a quote-unquote level 1, it'd be very hard to train them like immediately to get to level 7, but you might be able to move them up one notch and another notch over time? Or do you think it's like really hard for people to move out of those levels?
It's like rings of a tree. It's immutable in the context of business. It takes years to move from one stratum to another. Even for folks who have stratum 6 and stratum 7 potential, maybe in their 20s or like a stratum 4, it's going to take decades for you to move from one to the other. So it's the same reason that how long did it take General Petraeus to make general officer? Even with incredible training and Princeton and everything else, it took decades for him to go from second lieutenant to seeing the field.
That means in your case, like only somebody who's 40 years old or over can hit this, at least from my experience, that does seem like there are people who can do that much faster.
Yeah, there's different places where you start from. There's just like speed, right? There's kids who are just naturally faster earlier on in life. And so it's just where you're plotting them out. I think you'd find a lot of the founders and CEOs who've been successful and are able to scale with the business naturally start much higher in terms of their ability to see the field. And then they're developing at a pretty fast clip. But it's different from skills development and training. And it's different from behaviors and habits where there is this innate cognitive capability that once you can see it, it's moving, but it's moving almost imperceptibly slow, almost like the way that you age. So it doesn't necessarily mean everyone's equal or starts from the same place by any means, but it does mean that once you see it, you can kind of know at what level that person can be successful at over the next 3 to 5 years.
It is, though, important when you have strategy to at least have a good understanding of the tactics. One of the things is that in fields that evolve very, very quickly, let's say marketing or something, which evolves very, very quickly, or a lot of technology-related things, someone who was good at tactics like 15 years ago, they might be quote-unquote good at strategy now, but the tactics have changed dramatically during that time. And if they're not like practicing, sometimes they end up having the wrong strategy because they miss the tactics. Or do you disagree?
I would probably say that's probably more of a stratum play. I mean, there is some of that where somebody's just got a process and a playbook and then they just come over and blindly try to apply it. It doesn't work anymore. But actually, this is why stratum's important. Into my own life over in Iraq, when I went over there, Rumsfeld and Casey were over there and they'd said, it's counterterrorism. So we're just going to stay on our fobs and we're going to go out, sally forth and come back. I would come back to base and I would tell the first sergeant, I was like, I feel like I'm Don Quixote, like tilting at windmills. Go out, get blown up. Al-Qaeda has a cup of chai tea. And after we roll through, they're back in control of the neighborhood. And it was General Petraeus who came in and said, it's not counterterror, it's counterinsurgency. That's really what's going on. Get out of your fobs, get into the neighborhoods. And then violence just went. So being able to diagnose the nature of the problem, truly to see the field, that's the first order thing. And you can see it when it's missing at the top. I would say Rumsfeld and Casey lower stratum. They were so fixated that it was counterterror. They couldn't even look at the metrics and realize after years that they were wrong. And it took General Petraeus to go, no, guys, it's this. And then here's the playbook for how we do that. And you can look at the metrics. It changed a military that was losing and on the verge of it.
But do you think like if you interviewed someone like Rumsfeld just with your normal questions, you'd be able to suss that out? Because obviously he was an incredibly intelligent guy and he could talk about almost anything in a super interesting, high-level way. But like a lot of intelligent people, you end up in a box and it's hard to get out of that box. You even see some of the best Wall Street traders, they end up in a box and end up losing all their money sometimes.
Yeah, I think you could see it. Because it's not about being smarter or articulate or like briefed on the facts. I mean, you'll get a lot of that with ACTs and SATs, like brilliant people who are lower stratum. They're brilliant on the fact, but they can't truly see the field. They don't actually understand how the concepts interrelate. They can't simplify it. They can't diagnose what's really going on. There will be some interplay with values, like ego obviously plays an incredibly important role in learning and being able to sort of adapt, which I think is an interesting thing to explore about how much humility and ego will get in the way of an accurate diagnosis of what's going wrong. When you look at somebody who's like really smart, but flunked the test for 4 years, something's wrong there. They were very dumb in terms of what they did. Same thing with Bremer, HBS guy. I'm sure he's very smart in terms of books. Didn't do what Alexander the Great did with Aristotle, which is don't disband the army, double their salaries, make them loyal to you. You can rule, create reconciliation.
If I had to diagnose the foreign policy, quote unquote, establishment over the last 25 years, I would say they all failed in the US. And these are incredibly smart. Like you and I met these people, incredibly smart, interesting people, but like to a T have all failed then.
Yeah. So yeah, because okay. They're smart in what way, right? They can be smart in terms of putting forth an argument.
PhD.
But when you look at where that argument hits the real world, they failed. So they're very dumb in that sense, which is unfortunate. When you run into higher level stratum, you'll see the time horizons over what time horizon are you thinking about? Like Elon Musk, he's thinking over millennia, how to make humans multiplanetary. Like whose brain works that way? We're like everything backwards planning from that. And I think, I know from what I experienced over in Iraq is that these really hard questions about, all right, we've captured all of Al-Qaeda. They're in prison in Camp Buka. What should we do with them? Let's let them go. And we let Baghdadi, who became the leader of ISIS, go. He became the leader of ISIS in our prisons in Camp Buka. And so who made that decision? What could go wrong that you would all of Al-Qaeda in Iraq go after they'd spend a year in prison together? And then you have the Kurds and the Yazidis running up the mountains, and it's awful because I've been in those villages and there's flowers in our body armor and just wonderful, beautiful people. You can have really smart people, just like you had Living Social here in DC that raised $1 billion and went to zero. And they can work really hard and take sacrifice like my friends who gave their lives for this country. And you can do it in a way that actually drives regression against what we want to advance in the world, which are Western values and freedom and so on.
All right, this has been really interesting. Last question we ask all of our guests. What conventional wisdom or advice do you think is generally bad advice?
Oh my goodness. There's like double-edged to all this stuff. So when folks say like, don't give up, stay the course, you have to really understand and dig deep into a framework for what they're talking about. If you stay the course, and again, you don't actually have a good idea about the root of the thing, you can end up in a really rough spot. And so when I started, I was pitching Troop Swap to our early investors, and they would come up to me and they go, Blake, I don't believe in that business model, but I believe in you, so I'm going to invest. And then they would show me a picture of their kids. And this happened not just once or twice, but like a little kid. And they're like, this is my daughter's like college fund. She's counting on you. So I'm like, hey, man, so you don't believe that this business is going to work. You're still investing. And then you're guilt tripping me with your child. Holy crap. And so one of the things that allowed me to be successful, but it was still really hard, was I had a very clear idea of what scientific experiment I was running, that I was like, this is my hypothesis of what the problem is. These are my assumptions. And as I run these tests, I'm going to either validate or invalidate these assumptions. And I think as an entrepreneur, you really have to know that, so that if you're going to stay the course and not quit, you are learning, because entrepreneurship is really about finding a secret in the market that nobody else knows about, then capitalizing on that and exploiting. It's like a legal form of insider trading. If you have a clear hypothesis and you've got clear assumptions that you're either validating or invalidating, I think you give it enough time, you're eventually going to be successful. You're going to find something that nobody knows and you're going to be able to go get it.
As long as you keep iterating.
As long as you keep iterating. So that's a little bit paradoxical, because a company doesn't fail when the money runs out, company fails when the founder gives up. You have to have that quantitative side of it, that framework, before you get into the qualitative stubbornness of like staying the course. And both of those things have to be true at the same time. It's why it's so difficult to breathe a new company into life.
In some ways, you need to unwind a trade when it's going against you.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And then say, that's fine. If that's like a secular current, what is that force that's moving me that I didn't anticipate before? If you can't beat them, how do I join it and like shift the boat so it's moving with it?
All right, this has been great. Thank you, Blake Hall, for joining us on World of DaaS. I follow you at Blake_Hall on Twitter. Definitely encourage our listeners to engage you there. This has been a ton of fun.
Thanks, Oren. Appreciate you having me on.
If you're a super data nerd, go to worldofdaas.com. That's DAAS, worldofdaas.com, and sign up for our weekly data as a service roundup newsletter.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, consider rating this podcast and leaving a review. For more World of DaaS, and DaaS is DAAS, you can subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts. And also check out YouTube for videos. You can find me at Twitter at Oren, that's A-U-R-E-N, Oren, and we'd love to hear from you.
World of DaaS is brought to you by Safegraph. Safegraph is geospatial data for physical places. Check it out at safegraph.com. And by Flex Capital. Flex Capital invests in data companies like those we talk about at World of DaaS. Check it out at flexcapital.com.